Hello, welcome back to the Football Diary podcast, where myself and Dave will be unpicking this weekend's Premier League action. And there's some pretty big talking points for us. We saw Brighton get their fourth win in a row against Manchester United, which surprisingly doesn't seem like a bit of a shock anymore, does it? Even winning at Old Trafford, we'll come to that game. Of course, you can see by the colours I have on and behind me, I want to talk about Villa and their outstanding win against Crystal Palace. Another win for Unai Emery's boys to help them get back on track in the league after a disappointing result against Liverpool last time out. We'll look at Spurs and their charge up the table as well. A 2-1 win for them. They left it late, but they got the 3 points. And of course, we want to look at Chelsea because that seems to be the biggest situation in the league that's confusing people right now. We'll try and unpick that and look at where they can find some success. But Dave, first of all, I'll ask, how are you? I feel like I know the answer after the weekend.
Mixed feelings. Yeah, I've had a good weekend, but yeah, apart from the football results.
And just to be clear, normally I give Mike a lot of stick when he doesn't appear on the podcast, but actually he's not with us today because he's turning 40. So yeah, I'm going to air that for him, mate. Let all of you know just how old he is. Dave, you got a message for your brother-in-law on his 40th?
Not really, no.
It'll be in a card somewhere, won't it? Well, if anyone wants to leave a comment with any comments for Mike on his 40th, I'm sure he'd appreciate it. Let's start with his club then, and yours, of course. Let's look at Manchester United and how on earth they've lost 3-1 at home to Brighton. Now, let's not forget, Brighton got the same result against Newcastle, who were flying high last season as well. And we're going to give Brighton plenty of credit shortly, Dave, of course, because they deserve so much. But it seems only right, seeing as I'm sat with you, that we start with United and Ten Hag and his untenable position, it feels like, right now, doesn't it? What happened in this one for you, Dave? Where did United get this game wrong more than Brighton got it right?
I think the main issue at the minute is the midfield, and it seems like we're so open to conceding opportunities and chances for the teams, and it's not just that. It's the lack of decisiveness in attacking areas as well. We don't seem to create a great deal. And it's actually just really sad situation for United fans at the minute. It doesn't feel like there's a lot of positivity around the club. Obviously, everything that's going on behind the football side as well is ugly. But the performance itself, I mean, for the first 20 minutes or so, I didn't think we actually did too badly. But then we had a lot of gaps that kept appearing in midfield. And we saw Brighton taking off, you know, advantage of those wider areas where we really struggled to kind of get men over into those areas to help on with the defensive side. I think we saw McTominay helping a lot on their left side, but he couldn't quite get over where we saw actually the first goal come from. And it's just disappointing, I think, as a fan, because it's almost like you just expect it now. I didn't really have expectations before this game this weekend. I thought Brighton had a very good opportunity of getting a result, and it's kind of a happy hunting ground for them at the moment. But it's there's just no stability in the team. That's the worrying thing for me. Is feels like that you just don't know what you're going to get, what's going to turn up. There's no consistency. There's no rhythm at all. And you're looking for people to stand and be counted, and who are your leaders in that team? I mean, they're meant to be Bruno Fernandes. You know, Lisandro Martinez, he's had an indifferent start to the season as well. I think he's looked completely off the pace. Casemiro looks like he's played 100 games
shadow
summer. You know,
he looks
a lot slower. So,
do you know what though, Dave? Before you go further, I do want to talk to you about that a little bit, because actually that was the thing I noticed about United this week, that after the international break, there were a lot of people sort of clamouring for Scott McTominay to come into the side because his form for Scotland was excellent, and I can understand why. He was put into the midfield as part of like a diamond almost, and I don't think that's necessarily the position people expected him to occupy. I think the thought was that he would kind of take the place of Eriksen maybe and offer some stability in the middle. And instead, United kind of sacrificed the right-hand side and took their winger out, because obviously we know there's issues with Antony and Jadon Sancho right now off the pitch. So they're limited in terms of what they can do with selection. But is Brighton the right game to play such a narrow formation when you know how dangerous their wingbacks can be? And okay, they were missing Salim Arch in this game, but we'll talk a bit about the impact of Tarik Lamptey when he came in. You know what Matoma can do to you on that left-hand side as well. And United chose this weird narrow formation. So do we have to put some of the responsibility with Ten Hag for his selection as well? Because there's been a lot said about the form of Casemiro and the defensive players, but realistically, did Ten Hag get some of this wrong?
Yeah, I see what you're saying. And I think, you know, he's not immune to criticism, and rightly so, you know, especially at Man United. And but I think he went with his probably his more experienced team. There were a lot of young players on that bench as well. And you have to weigh up the situation. You look at how many injuries United have got at the minute. You know, if you don't play McTominay there in midfield, then potentially what if you're going to play a midfield three, you're going to be looking, I think Hannibal was pretty much our only other midfield option on the bench.
I thought instead you'd see a midfield three of McTominay, Casemiro and Fernandes, and that maybe Palestri would get a game on the right-hand side and just keep that same formation. But it didn't seem like he wanted to do that.
Yeah, and he's, you know, he must have his reasons. And I think that's the annoying thing for me is we've seen Bruno play on the right and he's nowhere near the player when he played more central. And also, I think there was a lot of talk as well whether we're going to play actually McTominay a little bit more advanced, probably sit Bruno further back where we tend to a bit more control of the game, and nothing can happen either. So it's annoyingly not fascinating for me.
To be honest, I've got so much sympathy with Ten Hag in terms of the overall situation at the club. We've talked about it enough. We talked about it a lot last week and everything that was kind of going wrong behind the scenes. And I think there were massive signs of that again in this game. I think you look at someone like Victor Lindelof, he just didn't look up to it at all. I think he looked really poor next to Martinez, who you're right, hasn't had a great start either. And when you consider the failure to invest in that area of the pitch over the summer, now perhaps that's because they failed to get rid of Harry Maguire as well. But we talked openly through the summer about their interest in Kim Min-jae, and they missed out on him and then didn't address that area. I feel like it's biting them now. I think, though, it's hard to say, but from my perspective, last week, yourself and Mike were talking about how you backed Ten Hag in the way that he dealt with the Sancho situation. Having reflected on it a bit more and looked into it a little bit more, I have to say, I wonder actually if I would side with the player a little bit more than we did last week. Now, the only reason I say that is I understand Ten Hag is trying to take this stance of no one's bigger than the club. You have to earn your place at United. And we've seen him deal with some pretty complicated characters. We've seen him remove Cristiano Ronaldo from the club, for example. However, I do wonder whether this situation has been handled in the right way with the current strength of the squad, and whether actually talking about Sancho so publicly last week was the right move in the first place. He'd obviously talked quite openly last year about Sancho's struggles with his own mental health, and from what I've heard, wasn't cleared to do that either. So you can see why Sancho might feel a bit, I don't know, aggrieved by his situation at Man United when he's got people like, at first, Greenwood and now Anthony getting in the team ahead of him, and Ten Hag talking about the attitude needing to be right to play for Man United. I think I would want to speak out as well. And I think anyone in a workplace who feels like their manager is doing the wrong thing or representing the wrong ideal might want to communicate that. And the easiest way Sancho had to do that was to reply. I think everyone has a right to reply. And then in this game, when you feel like your squad is so short of talent, in fact, if Ten Hag was a good man-to-man manager in the way that we've been told he is, would he have not had his arm around Sancho and encouraged him back into the side in some way? I don't know. What do you think? Do you think that this situation might come to bite Ten Hag eventually?
I mean, it's so easy to speculate, isn't it, from the outside? And obviously what we've seen and heard is only kind of manners, rumours, nothing really, you know, solid apart from statements that have come out from both individuals. And it is a bit annoying because it's blown up more than it need to be. It's provided distraction, and you can imagine it's probably not the best atmosphere in the dressing room, really. and been taken away from first team training as well. And what does that mean? He's not in the dressing room. Has he been in the dressing room and he's, you know, training or with the under 18s or training away completely away from, you know, the first team altogether? It's just a little bit unsettling for me.
And it's a shame, isn't it? And those wide areas look like they should have so much potential for Man United, and you've invested heavily in them and also brought someone like Marcus Rashford through. So they should be your most dangerous areas of the pitch. I actually wondered about Rashford's contribution as well, because last season, United played so much of it without a recognised number nine, and that enabled Rashford to be the main goal threat, even from a wide position. When you have a number nine and someone like Højlund, how does Rashford need to adapt his game to play well with Højlund? Because it felt like, obviously, that's a really new partnership and that's going to take time to build, but it felt very rusty in this game. And you could see Højlund was quite frustrated with that at times. Where does Rashford need to work to make that effective in your next match? Because you got Bayern midweek. It's not a rest for United now, is it?
No, and that it's definitely areas of his game he needs to be a bit smarter. I feel there was an instance in the game where he had it on, I think, on the left wing, and Højlund was making that run into the box. Basically, there was a clear pass there for a pullback. It would have been a tap in if he'd gotten it, but Rashford decided to shoot. And I've seen a lot, it's blown up a lot on social media saying, people saying, oh, well, you know, if that's City and that's Grealish or Foden, it's getting pulled back every single time. But that, the thing is, they've been drilled to play that way for years and years. The Pep Guardiola, do you know what I mean? It's a completely different environment, way of playing. And I feel like that's probably something he's going to have to get used to. Have him really, because we've not really been playing with a centre forward. You know, obviously we have Ronaldo. We've had obviously Martial at times, but I've not really been that sort of player to make those runs, you know, towards the back post or attacking areas where they can actually threaten the goal. And it's going to take a bit of time to adapt, I feel. Before anything is, we're already well into the season. And there's no time to adapt, really.
That idea of time, this is the last thing I want to ask you about Man United, because I want to give Brighton as much time as they deserve. But you talk about time briefly. Does Ten Hag have a lot of time? Is he under any pressure right now? Is there a part of you that wonders whether people will consider Ten Hag's role?
No, because the people above him aren't capable of making the right decisions anyway. They aren't capable of putting the right people. In fact, they're not even, they shouldn't even be in the positions that they're in to make these decisions.
Is it not so familiar as well? Like, Ten Hag joined and in his first summer was kind of given everything he wanted. And then the second summer they went, whoa, 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 we gave you all that last year, so why am I giving you more now? Didn't the exact thing that happened to Solskjaer and Mourinho?
Yeah, I mean, obviously, I think Mourinho wanted Maguire, didn't he, before?
He did, yeah, he did. And then Solskjaer got him first summer.
Yeah, that's the main thing, isn't it, really? I think I've seen a lot bandied about saying we've not really been able to make any sort of marquee signings. And obviously, Højlund signed for a lot of money. But
is that a marquee signing?
No, ultimately, no. He's a player with big potential and we've overpaid for him.
Well, you mentioned money, and it's an interesting one with Man United. And Ten Hag came out after the game, didn't he? And as he has done the last couple of games, I think made quite silly comments to try and deflect some of the pressure, maybe. And he said that it's hard in the league now because everyone spends a lot of money. Even Brighton spend a lot of money. Now, De Zerbi's been there a year. I think they broke their transfer record in the summer with João Pedro, who came off the bench. Starting 11 was worth 16.7 million. And they beat Man United at Old Trafford. So I feel like, Dave, I need, as your friend, to give you a bit of a break from mode about Man United. Should we talk about something positive and talk about Brighton? Because they were outstanding, weren't they? This is their fourth win in a row, as we mentioned, against Man United. And a year into De Zerbi's reign, they're one of the highest properties in the Premier League. Their attacking output is just absolutely incredible. They've had more shots than any other team in the Premier League since De Zerbi took over. I think they've got the third most amount of goals, which is not something that we were used to in the Brighton side. So why is it so easy for them to cut through a team like Man United these days? What did they do right in this game for you, Dave?
I just feel as though it's really interesting with Brighton, because we keep talking about all of the players that they've had and they've replaced, and but they can just keep on evolving as a team. And no matter what starting 11 is playing, they just, it seems like they've got their system and their principles completely instilled into them, and they know how to play, but how to get a result. And they're just so easy on the eye, aren't they? They're actually probably one of the enjoyable teams to watch in the league for me.
Pascal Gross's goal was a 30-pass move as the away side at Old Trafford. That's just, it's unheard of, it feels like, isn't it? It was just outstanding football. And De Zerbi just manages to achieve that in every single game. And you're right, it doesn't seem to matter who is playing. They were missing Ferguson in this game, and Ciso, Solly March, who's been a revelation at Brighton in the last year, all missing. And you're right, we find a new player to talk about and sing their praises all the time. It feels like after this game, we've got to go back to an old player that we sang praises of a long time ago and look at Tarik Lamptey, because it felt like for a while he was the next big fullback coming through in the Premier League, and he was going to end up going to Man City or Arsenal or even United. And then over the last year, he's barely got into the Brighton team. Like he's featured very, very little. And no pun intended, because I know he's quite slight, isn't he? But he was incredible down that left-hand side in this game, wasn't he? I think he got 2 assists in the game. And it shows the strength and depth that Brighton have got now. They're bringing on Ansu Fati off the bench in this game as well, João Pedro. Do you think that depth means Brighton are looking for even more than they achieved last year?
On Lamptey, I think it was actually quite clever to play him in this game as well, because we had Reguilón, who's obviously making his first start. Rashford's not the strongest in helping his fullback out either. I don't know whether that was actually quite a clever ploy by Zerbi and actually starting him and just thinking we can overrun him on that side. And it proved to be the case as well. Like you mentioned, they ended up creating quite a bit from that wing. It was actually, like you mentioned, it's good to see him back in form again.
Yeah, absolutely.
Like you say, he's a really promising player, and I feel like he probably felt a little bit sort of, you know, annoyed at the situation potentially, because he came, actually, like you mentioned, we were speaking about him quite a lot, saying, you know, this guy come in and potentially be coming in for England and making a claim for a place, really.
Well, he's playing for Ghana now, isn't he? Because that's kind of the level. That sounds like an insult to Ghana. It's absolutely not. I think they've got some fantastic players. And I know that Ghana spent a lot of time investing in trying to get players with their nationality to side for them rather than a side like England. But he is an international footballer now as well. So there is some experience behind him. Is he kind of a symbol of what De Zerbi is achieving now, though? That these players can fight for a place in a team that are getting into Europe and not just be guaranteed starters? Because you probably could have picked the Brighton 11 for many, many years. And now it's really hard to do that, isn't it?
It's difficult, yeah. And in a way, it also challenges their mentality, because you see players, obviously, especially at United, it almost feels like you can't take your place for granted. Well, you shouldn't, but it feels like there's a few players in our team that do. And it almost seems like the mentality in their squad is absolutely on point, because, like you mentioned, he chops and changes and he gets a tune from them. But I just feel as though it's really interesting to see where they can actually go this season, because they had obviously a really good season last year. They lost a couple of obviously really key players in McAllister and Casado, but where do they aim from here? I mean,
well, that's what I was going to ask you, because they start their European journey on Thursday as well. They've got a difficult game against Athens, obviously, and they're in a tough group as well, Brighton. But realistically, with that squad, with the way De Zerbi has got them playing, the attacking style that they bring to the Premier League, Are they knocking on the door of the top five this season? Or maybe are they going to give the Europa League a good run? What do you think Brighton aim for?
It's a really difficult question, isn't it? And I think they've got there's definitely key players in there. I feel like they've got to keep fit. You mentioned Ferguson. I think he's massive for them. And João Pedro, I think, is an absolute brilliant signing for them.
Yeah, when he settles, that's fantastic.
He's always had so much potential, and he definitely stood out when he was at Watford. He just looked that he could play a couple of levels above, and he's back in the Premier League now. And I just think maybe between 6 and 8, anywhere between there, is pretty good.
With European football alongside it, I think you're right.
European football, I just feel as though the way they've progressed as a club and how far they've come in such a little amount of time, it's absolutely amazing, such a great story. So if they can just keep doing what they're doing, being such a joy to watch for all us fans of the Premier League, you know, I'm happy with that, as long as it's not beating United every time they play it.
It very well might be, let's be honest. Okay, so from one team that obviously was revolutionised under a new manager and got themselves into Europe to another, let's talk about my boys, Dave, because Aston Villa came back from the international break looking fresh and beat Crystal Palace 3-1. It took two very late goals to seal the win, and we'll talk about the game in a bit more detail and how that went on. But I wanted to talk about this game because I was really, really enjoying the performance as a whole. I think the first half, obviously, they weren't clinical enough and they struggled to get the goal. But the way that they dominated play and the kind of football they played and the calm and measured approach that Emery has brought to that team, I think speaks wonders of how well coached that side is. And there are a few players in there that have really kicked on from last season. And I wanted to talk about a few of them. I know you're going to focus in on one of them for us a little bit later on when we get to the goals. But let's just talk through the game really quickly. Obviously, Palace took the lead in the second half. From a Villa fan's point of view, it was a very unfortunate situation. Obviously, Martinez slips as he comes out to try and collect a cross. And it falls very well to Edouard, who's in great form. So you expect him to take the chance when it falls to his feet. But other than that, Palace didn't create a great deal. Everything sort of ran through Eberechi Eze, and Martinez, I think, had a really good game other than that one moment and stopped him a couple of vital moments where Palace maybe could have sealed the game. But then Villa get themselves back into it. Obviously, substitutions worked. Duran came on and scored. We'll talk about him in a little while. Bailey came on and scored at Villa Park again. He just loves scoring at home, clearly. And then there was the Douglas Luiz penalty that I want to talk about as well. So let's start with Douglas Luiz for a second, Dave. He won possession 16 times in that game, which is the most of any player in a Premier League match. He also scored once again in the league, which is just brilliant to see him get his tally up. The calmness of that penalty late on in the game, the level that he's at now, Dave, can we see why Villa was so desperate to hold on to him last summer and this year? And what's his ceiling within that team, do you think?
The second half of last season, he was an absolute revelation. You know, it's not just the start of the season. He's kind of carried that form on into this season. He's looked, you know, like mainly, arguably, probably one of the most important player in your team when he's on his game.
Yeah, I think so.
I feel as though we know he's always been a player with obviously massive talent. I feel like he could, you know, he could be as good as he wants to be, really. He's got that. He's got quite a well-rounded game. You know, he's not particularly certainly strong in certain areas. Obviously he is, but he's not weak in many areas either.
Which, no, not at all.
You know, obviously a big positive in the way that Emery wants them to play actually suits him perfectly. And it's almost like the confidence, his confidence is on another level at the minute, the way, if you look at the ways. But I feel like you mentioned his tenacity is his main thing about his game. You mentioned 16 times running the ball in a game.
It's crazy.
It's really, you know,
and do you know what's really nice? There was all that talk about him going to Arsenal last year, and then there was loose talk of Liverpool looking at him this summer. He scores that penalty. He runs over to the corner flag, which represents AVFC on the side. He holds it out to the crowd and he makes it all about the club. And I love that because he's been with us now, I think 3 years, and has had opportunities to go, has seen his game time limited at times. Obviously, there was a bit of a personal situation where he was in a relationship with Alicia Lehmann and that broke up. And you thought, yeah, you could see why he might move on at times, but it seems like he's so settled there. And I wonder if that's what a coach like Unai Emery manages to do, get players settled. Obviously, there was comments from Yuri Tielemans during the international break where he was saying he wasn't really happy with his game time so far at Villa. Now, a lot of people kind of jumped on that and were a bit like, oh, he's already moaning and, oh, that's a problem. But actually, I kind of love that. I want someone to say, no, I really want to play here. I want to be featuring. And it wasn't so much a, oh, it's ridiculous. I hate my time here. He said, I'm not happy with it right now, but I'm going to work to get there. And he came on in this game, played two incredible passes that both led to goals. And I thought really showed what he can bring. So that depth is definitely there. We also saw two of the other new signings really shine. Zaniolo in the first half, I thought was outstanding, created three big chances and should have had the assist of the season if it weren't for Matty Cash just completely hitting an air shot where he does this lovely turn and nutmegs the defender on the byline and cuts the ball back. It was just fantastic. And we saw the kind of flair he's going to bring. Moussa Diaby sadly had a goal ruled out for offside after an exquisite first touch. So unbelievable, wasn't it?
Great.
And he's now got he's got two goals, two assists in the Premier League so far in five games. That's a great impact, isn't it? What do you think?
He seems like he's got such a cool head on his shoulders as well. Like,
yeah,
how composed he was with that finish. In fact, you know, that would have been a great
goal. Do you know, my only slight criticism of him at the moment is I almost think he's got too cool of a head. And sometimes I want him to be a bit more selfish. Like, I've seen a few opportunities where I thought, lash that a goal. And he's tried to square it and it's not really been the right moment to pass it. So I want him to be a bit more clinical, but that will come with time. I think he's been outstanding. And we talk about how Emery is coaching players and we talked about, so Douglas Luiz, like we said, most times a player's won possession in a single game in the Premier League this season. Excellent. Luca Dean's put seven successful crosses into the penalty area so far this season, the most of any player in the Premier League. Outstanding. So clearly being coached really well. Pau Torres in this game made 117 successful passes. It's the most of any Aston Villa player in Premier League history. Well, since records have been kept. Right. And he just dictated the entire game and actually spent loads of the game just on the edge of Crystal Palace's final third, just telling you where he wanted it. I think only Lewis Dunk has progressed the ball up the pitch more than him, carried the ball up the pitch more than him so far. And he didn't start the first game. So clearly Emery's impact on those players and the impact they're having on the league is really shining through. And we talked briefly about the first Villa goal, the equaliser, coming from 19-year-old John Duran. What do you make of him, Dave? Because this is kind of, this is his chance now. Obviously, Cameron Archer got moved on. He is the understudy to Ollie Watkins. And at the moment, he's taking his chances when he gets them, isn't he?
Yeah, and obviously there has been plans there for him to obviously make a pathway into the team at some point. Obviously, he needed a lot of patience, I feel, last season. Obviously, he came in January, didn't he? It's easy to forget how young he is. You know, he's still 19 and turns 20 in December, I feel. But he's had actually quite a quick turnaround. His career, his last three clubs, obviously started at Envigado. I think he made his debut at the age of 15, which is just crazy.
Crazy, isn't it? He's a unit, though, so I'm not surprised.
And moved, obviously, to Chicago in the MLS and made 27 appearances. I think scored 8 goals, obviously, which is quite a good return. And obviously, that got a lot of attention. And I think United were actually linked with him. A few big clubs, actually.
There's a lot of clubs. There was.
But he's actually starting to show, you know, what he's all about. I feel, obviously, his strengths. He's quite a quick player. He's, you know, look at his physique. He's really strong. He's quite good aerial prowess. And his finishing ability is quite two-footed as well. So
I feel like... Oh, that finish. The way he hit that ball.
The technique of it, wasn't it? Just so,
yeah,
you know, absolutely beautiful to watch.
It's not in the corner, but no keeper's got a chance the way he hits it.
It's just, you don't, you know, when it comes that kind of clean off the boot, you don't see it very often. It just absolutely bursts.
Mate, if I was sat in the whole tent, I'd have been terrified.
But he's still, I think it's easy to forget, he's still quite raw. Like I say, it's very early on. I think he needs a bit of patience, but I think the perfect start for him will be, I think you play Everton, don't you, in the League Cup in a couple of weeks. Which might be a good opportunity for him to start.
Well, we've got Legia Warsaw on Thursday, and I'd be really surprised if he didn't start that game, if I'm totally honest. Because I think the thing with Duran is when he came in last season, he came on in a few games and he looked nervous. It was a big move. And he looked really nervous. And then this season, he came on, he got that really early goal against Everton after he came on. And since then, he's looked the most confident person in Villa Park. And that is such a telling thing. I think he's always going to be given a bit more confidence by the backing of the manager. And like I said earlier, moving Archer on tells Duran, you are my man. You are the one that I want to see come through here. I think there's more potential in you right now than Archer potentially. And the way that he conducts himself on the pitch, there was a bit of a funny incident against Liverpool where he kind of squared up to Joe Gomez, and he's clearly like quite sure of himself. And that's what you want from a striker, particularly a young striker. You want him to go, when I get that chance, I'm going to take it. I think I saw earlier his XG for the Premier League so far this season is like 0.7, and he's got two goals out of it. So he's gonna take the chances he gets. And that's what Villa need, really, because Watkins, for all the goodwill I have for Watkins and for all he does for the team, hasn't started the season in the most clinical form in the league. Obviously, he got a hat-trick in the Conference League qualifier, but I wonder whether actually that might be a perfect partnership at times, because Watkins will do the running, Watkins will do the work, and Duran will do the finishing. Perfect. I'll take that. Just to move on quick, unless you've got something you want to add about Duran quickly.
Yeah, I was just going to say he's a completely different proposition, isn't he, I think, to Watkins. And that's, you know, the thing you want, different options on the bench and different options in your squad where because it can offer something completely different. And I feel like that's obviously, it almost feels like probably Emery felt like he's got a little bit more to his skill set than probably Cameron Archer has or had. Mm. And he's such a powerful player that, in fact, you need somebody sometimes to play. If you're going to play differently, maybe you need, you know, obviously a striker to kind of go and dominate those centre-backs and provide more of a different problem. So I feel like
it's been an
interesting one to watch, isn't it?
Yeah, a lot of early comparisons to Benteke. I'll take that. Before we move on from Villa, because I'm conscious of what else we've got to talk about, I do want to just ask for your take on the penalty, because I actually was really happy for a change. Maybe it's because it's my team and it worked in our favour, to see a referee go to the monitor and stick with his decision. Because for me, look, again, I'm a Villa fan, so I'm always going to say I think it's a penalty. I thought it was really clearly a penalty because he gets a lot of the ball after he's taken Watkins out. Mm. So that's a foul to me. If you take the player first, that's a foul. And I thought, for a change, we heard so much that VAR was in place for clear and obvious errors. And I don't think you could clearly say he got the ball before the man. So the ref said, no, I don't want to change that decision. That's rare, isn't it, Dave? We're used to saying, well, when the ref goes to the monitor, you know that the decision's changing. Do you think that England made the right call here? Do you think it was a penalty?
I think it was a penalty. Like you mentioned, it didn't seem as though he got a great deal of the ball. It did seem like he got the man first. And I'm actually quite surprised, actually, that VAR kind of said to him, you know, go over and look at the monitor and have a second at it. Because surely they would have just thought, hang on, it's not entirely clear. We're going to go with a decision and back him in that instance.
Yeah, I thought that as well. Yeah. But it stood. And that's a major thing. And I think it's really nice because I'm used to seeing Villa, particularly at Villa Park, try and blow teams away in the first 20 minutes and then see how the game progresses. And in this game, we went behind, but got ourselves back into it and did so really, really well. They didn't panic. They didn't change the game up very much. They let it continue as it was, and they were fantastic. So, yeah, really happy. Just a quick note, obviously, Roy Hodgson wasn't at the game. He was taken to hospital. I haven't seen an update on that today, actually. I don't know if you have, Dave, but whatever that situation is, obviously, hope that Hodgson's back very soon, because national treasure, Roy Hodgson. And actually, Crystal Palace, generally speaking, have been really, really good this season, and I think are benefiting from him being back. So, yeah, hopefully his health okay. I got a quiz for you, Dave. Okay. I'm going to read you some of the players on the bench for a Premier League team this weekend. I want you to tell me which team it was. Okay. So I've got to look at my list that I've got written here. Petrovic, Bergstrom, Gilchrist, Stutter, Washington, Matos. Which team had those players on their bench this weekend?
Was it Sheffield United?
It was a team that has recently spent £1 billion in the transfer market. They were players on Chelsea's bench this weekend. And you and I think, are football nerds. I would go as far as saying we've been doing this podcast for nearly 3 years and been watching football our whole lives and have never heard of the majority of those players. I did leave out the likes of Ben Chilwell, who was on the bench, because that would have given it away. But let's talk about Chelsea quickly, because they drew 0-0 with Bournemouth this weekend in a very uninspiring performance. Again, even after everything that they've done in the last few windows and the investment they've had, that's their bench, which is a bizarre turn of events. And I know they've got a lot of injuries. They had a lot of players unavailable. They were obviously missing Caicedo and Lavia, two of their big signings for the summer in this match as well. Reece James is still out. But what's going on with Chelsea, Dave? Because they're 14th in the league after five games. They've scored five goals. Yeah. I mean, they failed to score in the last 200 minutes. I don't even know what to say. Like, I made you tell me how bad United were earlier, so it's only fair I give you this one back. Tell me, mate, what's going on with Chelsea?
You can't even find it funny when your own team are doing absolutely terrible themselves there. So.
I find it hilarious then.
Well, if you think roles reversed this time last year, Miles, you were in a pretty bad spot.
And I'm quite confident that Chelsea won't turn it around as fast as we did, because Unai Emery's got a job.
It's been more of the same, hasn't it? They're struggling to score goals. Defensively, they've not actually looked too bad, to be fair. Midfield's not really been an issue for them as well. And obviously, we've seen Enzo Fernandez has been, you know, very good this season so far. It's just something.
But talking about leaving, apparently.
Well, are you surprised?
Well, no, maybe not with the way things are going, but
there's a lack of cutting edges in there, isn't there? I mean, Chelsea did have quite a few opportunities in this game, to be fair. They just couldn't take their chances.
Why can't they take the chances? Because they've got Mudrick and Nicholas Jackson playing up top.
The comments that obviously Pochettino came out of the game, didn't he, and said that he needs a better understanding of the game about Mudrick. Says a lot. You know,
but while you're on that, can we just also address the other thing that Pochettino said, which isn't putting any pressure on any player, obviously. He said something along the lines of, and apologies if I don't get this exactly right. He said, I remember a time when Real Madrid signed a midfielder, and after 6 months, they weren't very happy with him because it took him some time to settle. And his name was Zinedine Zidane. And look how your Real Madrid fans feel about him now. Do we think, Dave, that Nicholas Jackson or Mudrick will go on to have a career as successful as Zinedine Zidane?
Will anyone?
Well, there you go. Go on. What were you saying about Mudrick and Jackson before I interrupted you? I found that hilarious.
I remain quite positive about Jackson. I feel like there's a good player in there.
That's biased because you called him as your player to watch at the start of the season. You don't want to sound wrong.
That as well. But I'm definitely encouraged a lot more about him than I am Mudrick. Also, Mudrick, right. Chelsea was completely in the wrong scenario.
Yeah, it was.
He would have been a lot better off at Arsenal, just because Arsenal were in a much better state, a lot healthier position in the league. Obviously, a lot of young players. They've got a manager in.
Could have been integrated a lot slower as well.
Yeah, I think so. Mm. And, you know, let's be honest, he's in a massive squad surrounded by a bunch of strangers to him, really.
Yeah.
Who are your experienced players in there now at the clubs?
Thiago Silva, and that's it. Because even the experienced ones like Ben Chilwell and Reece James have only played about six games in their entire career because they're always injured. They're just old and injured.
Reece James is probably the most experienced.
Conor Gallagher was captain this weekend.
Yeah, I saw that. I was quite surprised by it.
Yeah. We thought he was going.
Yeah. it's a strange situation all around. And they're just looking for a break, aren't they, really? It's going to be another... It's definitely a transitional period for this team.
Mm. How long do they get to transition, though? Because we said that about Potter and his team. Does Poch come and... I'm not saying after five games he's under pressure, absolutely not. But can we see Pochettino getting this squad clicking? And can we see him getting the time to let that happen?
I think another thing as well, it's been actually really difficult for him. If you look at the amount of injuries that They've got obviously, you know, Chukwuemeka, who's actually had a really bright start to the season, played quite well.
Sack him. Don't like him.
obviously, Nkunku,
Jacob Ramsey, better.
Anything off, but we know.
That's so unfortunate, isn't it? I love Nkunku. I think he'll be great for Chelsea when he comes through.
In a way, he's not really been able to figure out himself how he's going to set up and what plays he's going to have, especially in the attacking areas. You know, Reece James continues to get injured every other week. So
he's made of glass.
It's such a difficult spot to be in. I can't really criticise him too much at the minute because I actually really sympathise for the position that he's in.
A bit of credit to Bournemouth. I mean, you talked about Chelsea having their chances. I think Bournemouth had one less shot on goal than them.
Yeah.
They were trying to counter-attack. Not quite clinical enough. It just felt like Dominic Solanke, the pressure kind of got to him in this game. His former side, obviously, wasn't his last touch kind of let him down a few times. For me, it was really nice seeing Justin Kluivert come on. I think he had a really good impact on the game and someone that I followed for a little while because of his time at Roma. So it's nice to see him get a chance in the Premier League. But Iraola, can he get Bournemouth clicking, do you think?
I think he already has in ways. From what I understand, but obviously Bournemouth last season, you know, there was a real collective effort, but it almost seems like they've actually gone one further this season. And actually, in terms of what Arrow is doing, it's obviously becoming more of a pressing side, but working harder as a unit. But they seem to like they're being a little bit more hostile in their pressing. And it's triggered, obviously, a lot more turnovers, apparently, compared to last season. So it seems to definitely be, his methods seem to be working for me. And if you look at how they do play, if you look at the squad as a whole, kind of man for man against a lot of the other teams in the league, arguably they're probably one of the lesser talented squads probably in the league.
I think we'll see him invest in January as well, because they have got a bit of money these days, haven't they? A little bit anyway.
No chance he would have come into that team and they would have said,
yeah,
we're gonna, you, this is what you've got to work with. There would have been, I'd imagine, guarantees of a budget of some sort. And you know, he's obviously already bought in a few players at Sinister. Another player who's obviously come in, hasn't he, as well, who's a good option for them. But I actually think they'll stay up this season. I think.
Oh, yeah, I have no worry about Bournemouth staying up. I think they'll be fine. I mean, right now, they're one position behind Chelsea and two behind Man United. So it's not too bad. I'm going to fly straight over to the Spurs game quickly because I'm conscious that we've spent so much time talking about our own clubs, Dave, but we've got to give some credit somewhere else. Spurs, obviously. I talked about Villa getting a win late on. Well, Spurs left it even later, didn't they? And that wasn't for a lack of trying. In a game where they'd had 28 shots on goal, they eventually ended up 2-1 winners over Sheffield United. An interesting game for a few reasons. Obviously, Gustav Hamer scored for Sheffield United. It was an excellent goal. Like, he just looks like such a player to me. And I can't believe that it's not someone we've seen in the Premier League earlier in his career, or that even maybe clubs slightly above the calibre of Sheffield United weren't looking at him after his heroics with Coventry last year. I thought he might get a look, but I think he was fantastic. But Tottenham, Dave, they're second and they just keep winning. And it seems like Postecoglou's really got them clicking again. And in this game, their hero was an unlikely one. Richarlison came off the bench and had the impact that we've been waiting for him to have, really, didn't he? What do you think of the Spurs in this game?
Yeah, they keep on churning out the results, don't they? And, you know, they've had such a positive start to the season. We've obviously given Postecoglou so much praise already, but it almost seems like it's just the mood around the whole team is completely changing. I think I read an article, actually, from the Athletic, actually, earlier in the week, and mentioning that he's changed quite a few things around the team and the infrastructure and sort of like the player. For instance, one of the things is, I think the night before a game now, they actually, the players stay at home with their families, whereas before they would have actually stayed at accommodation they've got at the training ground, which apparently the players are really happy about. It means they've got another night. It's so simple, but in actual fact, it gives the players a bit more freedom. You know, it's not.
If you've been managed by Conte and Mourinho before that, who literally ban you from breathing unless it's in a certain way, then I'm not surprised they appreciate it.
But it's definitely such a happy place at the moment.
Yeah,
for the team, and it's Arsenal on Sunday, isn't it? Which is
huge.
It's going to be really interesting. I'm actually really excited. It's been a long time since I've been excited for a North London derby.
Do you think we underestimated Spurs at the start of the season then? Where do you see Spurs at the end of the year now?
It's a tough question to answer that.
I can't work it out. I think for the no Europe.
The big thing for me will be when they have probably a couple of bad results is how they respond. And if they do turn the corner and obviously go on another run, then they've kind of answered questions. That's going to be a big turning point for them if they can obviously respond to a negative result. But yeah, I think they'll be happy. They should be aiming for top four for me. You know, if we look at how last season ended, and it was, you know, such a downward spiral, wasn't it, for them really, when actually doing quite well again, you know, for a good chunk of the start of the season. I think they're around the top spot.
They flew around it for ages, and it seemed to be consistently United and Spurs would lose but be third and fourth still for ages, didn't it, last season?
And the thing is, we obviously spoke about it, didn't we, and we said we weren't sure on their squad and whether they've actually got players, and on the evidence of obviously last year, and you know, there's so many players that look completely different players, the likes of, you know, Bissouma, who's been outstanding for them. But the additions that they have made, obviously Brennan Johnson is another player who came off the bench.
Yeah.
Made a real good impact this week as well.
Quality signing.
I actually think they've been quite clever with the recruitment. But
we thought that last summer as well, if you remember. I remember talking on the podcast last summer and saying that we thought Spurs had won the transfer window with the business they'd done, the way they brought in Jed Spence, and we thought he was going to be the next big thing, and brought Perisic in for some experience. Richarlison was going to be Kane cover, and we were really, and Bissouma even, we were really singing their praises. But Postecoglou seems to have done the business and got them going really quickly, and actually brought the best out of some players that we probably thought were busted flushes. Like, even someone like Son, who obviously we weren't right enough after one poor season, already looks a different player. Mm. Richarlison scoring in this game could kick him on a bit further. Bissouma's been their best player so far this season. Madison's an excellent addition. So
him as well, didn't he?
Yeah, absolutely. It's really interesting to see where Spurs can get to, because this is the other question I wanted to ask you, and this is the interesting one when we consider some of the teams we've talked about already. The current top seven, right, are City, Spurs, Liverpool, Arsenal, West Ham, Brighton and Villa. How many of those teams don't finish in the top seven at the end of the season? United and Chelsea should have been targeting that area.
Yeah.
So it's going to be congested, and Newcastle aren't in that picture right now. So it's interesting. I more make that point. I don't really want you to answer that, because it's five games in, and for all we know, Villa could completely be derailed. West Ham might not keep up the kind of way they've started, although I think they played actually quite well against Man City. But I think it shows us what we kind of discussed at the start of the season, that all of a sudden, the gap, all right, is Man City, and then the gap between everyone else is a lot smaller, it feels like. The fact that Spurs are keeping that pace, no one would have seen that come in after five games. Maybe they need some more difficult fixtures, and then we'll see what happens, because I think the hardest game they've had so far was Man United, and they made that pretty easy, didn't they? But it's interesting. I'm really excited by the league this season. That's all I would say to that. One final quick thought while we talk about what the league looks like. There's been a lot of talk this week about the standard of refereeing and the changes to the rules and how that's affecting the game. I just wanted to get your take on a couple of things, Dave, because we've already touched on the VAR decision in the Villa game, for example. On that Saturday, there were 44 yellow cards given out, which was the most of a single day in Premier League history. Obviously, the rule changes in terms of time wasting have been talked about greatly. And like Eberike Eze went like this when a player took him down, and then he got booked as well. And that's come into the game a lot more this year. So we're seeing soft yellows for a lot. We're seeing time wasting supposedly clamped down on, although there was a big thing about Arsenal's goal against Everton. It took them 26 seconds to take the corner from when the ball was placed. I mean, even that game, there was that offside goal, which to me, I still find ridiculous how that was given as offside. But apparently that's the ruling. So what do you think, Dave? are we seeing too much impact from the laws and the referee? Like, do we, I know that sounds like an odd thing because obviously the rules are there to impact the game and the referees have to do their job, but is it spoiling it in some way at the moment? Are we happy with the current system and the rule changes?
A lot of managers have already aired their frustrations, haven't they? With
the rules. Yeah, it's going to cost one of them his job.
Yeah.
Heckenbottom looks like he might be being replaced by Chris Wilder this week, which is bizarre. And he had a massive rant about the referee, didn't he? Sorry, go on.
I don't blame him, but it is such a shame. It just seems like the game's just heading completely the wrong direction. You mentioned the yellow cards. It's just been an absolute joke. And I think Marco Silva's already had his opinion, said we'll have 200, yellow cards after, not even, God knows, six games. And that
feels like it.
Astounding, really. When you think about it and how many suspensions there's going to be. It's just ridiculous. And then they added on time. Again, I don't know whether I'm a fan of it either. I just think it's just changing games massively. It's changing, really.
Well, look, this week, how many late goals there were. We talked about the Spurs game, completely got turned around. The Villa game did too. Liverpool as well scored late on, didn't they? It's having an impact. City scored late as well.
Do you know what, as well? It actually spoils the drama a little bit because it's just going to become more so regular for teams to be scoring this late on because there's an extra, 10, 15 minutes of added time.
Mm.
Almost.
Yeah.
It's not really a surprise anymore. Whereas.
Yeah, that's true. If you're a team like Burnley, or maybe Burnley's a bit harsh because they're good football inside these days, but if you're a team of Burnley of old who might nick a 1-0 and then just sit back for 90 minutes, that's exhausting if you're then chasing a team like Man City. And then if that's then 100 minutes of football instead of 90, you're shattered. Well, so you are going to see late goals. You're going to make mistakes more often.
Sheffield United, didn't it?
Yeah, perfect example. I don't know why I didn't use the example that literally happened this week rather than create one out of thin air. But yeah, good point.
But it does, I think a lot have already mentioned, it seems to suit the bigger teams. Obviously the added time in that they tend to have a little bit more strength in depth on the benches and they're able to call this obviously talent and kind of exploit these situations. And I just don't know really where we go from here. Obviously, VAR, again, has been another absolute mess, really, through the whole season. Better. It's not improved. We still don't know what the right decisions are. We don't know the exact rules of certain things. And it's just...
The refs.
Well, yeah, the
refs. That's what Heckenbottom was saying, wasn't it? That he didn't feel like the refs knew what they were doing half the time.
Oh, no. Yeah, I think he said that they don't understand the game. They don't, they're in charge of something. They actually don't.
We've heard that before.
Which, yeah. I can see sort of, the reasoning behind that. But it is just so frustrating because we're seeing games decided still. Decisions that are just the wrong decision.
Feels like it.
You can just see why fans are so aggrieved and just so annoyed by it, or we really thought that we'd see some sort of progress by now, but it just seems to be getting worse.
Well, we'll see if we've got any more to talk about after next weekend. So it's an interesting weekend of Premier League football ahead because there's a lot of games on the Sunday because so many English teams are in European competitions this week, including Aston Villa, just a reminder. So we'll be back next week, Dave, to unpick all the Harry Kane goals against Man United this week. You thought he was gone, here he is. And then we'll look at the Premier League action, of course, as well. Mike will hopefully be back with us if he can get his bus pass to work. Now he's officially claiming his pension. We'll see whether he's got time for us anymore, if it's past his bedtime. Or he's probably watching reruns of Countdown, isn't he? Anyway, that's enough old jokes. Dave, thank you for joining me today. I'm sorry that you had to do it after another loss. One day, we'll talk about a good performance for United.
We'll be talking about United getting beat by Burnley next week, so we've got to go away to tip on.
To be honest, I did forget a very key question that I had ready for you, that if United were happy to bring back Johnny Evans, should they be looking at Danny Welbeck next and just get the whole band back together? Because he loves scoring against you, doesn't he?
Do you know what? It wouldn't be actually a bad option. That just says the state. That says a lot about our club, though.
He's a good player.
It says a lot about our club.
So. Yeah, I'm stopping you there, Dave, because we already did 12 minutes of you crying. So I don't want to do it again. Right. If you have stuck with us for this long and Dave crying and me gloating, then thank you. If you aren't subscribed to us on YouTube, please, please head over there. We really appreciate the support. We are getting very close to that magic 1,000, and that's a huge aim for us. We really do appreciate what you've done for us so far. Obviously, you can continue to listen to us on audio platforms as well. Follow us on our socials, Football Diary UK, everywhere. And until next week, cheers, Dave.
Cheers. Pleasure.
See you soon.